Thank you very much for inviting me. It's really great to be here, and I really enjoyed both the workshop and the conference, so I really want to thank the organizers for a really very fun and instructive experience. My talk will be about cooperation and construction, and I just on purpose left it kind of loose to try to work my way through these concepts. So when I first started to work in biology, everything seemed to be pretty easy. Cooperation was defined as, you know, someone pays a cost for somebody else to get a benefit. A free rider or a defector is someone who pays no cost but gets the benefit of an interaction with a cooperator. And so one can put it into such a matrix and study it as a game, and we look at the evolutionary dynamics and so on. And we know that natural selection in a well-mixed population doesn't select for cooperation, so then there are all these other mechanisms that can be discussed and have been discussed. And I spent a lot of time thinking about spatial structure and the effect that has on the evolution of cooperation. But then we started to work on the origin of eusociality, and eusociality is characterized as the social behavior, which is a bit more than just social because it not only has a division of labor, but it also has a division of reproduction. And so it originated many times, or a few times. One of the interesting things is that it's such a successful behavior that one of the questions is, if it's so good for the insects that do it, why hasn't it originated more often? The other question is, why would an ant, a worker ant, forgo its reproduction to help the mother raise more offspring? And so there's a lot of work that has been done, and it's been really interesting work. We just were thinking of doing a very simple model to describe the very transition to primitive eusociality. And in the process of doing so, we realized that it's actually not so easy to write it as a game. I mean, we just wanted to write our matrix and do our analysis as usual and see what comes out. But with eusociality, there seemed to be two different routes by which it could have been achieved. One is called the parasocial route, which is when two independent insects come together and they form a colony, and so it starts with a kind of a social behavior. And then there's the subsocial route, where offspring stay at the nest and help the mother raise more offspring. And so it seems that there is little support in the literature for the parasocial route, but a lot more for the subsocial route, so we tried to model that. But when you try to model a game between a parent and an offspring, it starts to be less like the types of games that we were trying to study before. So we felt that it was a little bit of a challenging task, and we ended up thinking, well, maybe we're not asking the question at the right level. Maybe we shouldn't ask, why would a worker ant forgo its own reproduction to help the mother? Maybe the right question to ask is at the level of the mother, what's the benefit of a mother who can make daughters that stay at the nest and help her? So we constructed this very simple model where we started with the precursor state, which was solitary, where we assumed that there is a valuable and defensible nest with dependable food source within foraging distance, and that the mother does progressive provisioning, like in birds. It gets food, it feeds the young, and when they mature, the young leave. And then we assume that perhaps eusociality can come about in a very simple way, maybe as a mutation or a string of mutation, that makes some of the daughters stay at the nest, maybe a fraction Q of the daughters. And if that's the case, and now these two things compete for the same resources in the same environment, the question is, which one does better? So we have now, we can set the problem as a competitive exclusion problem between two modes of reproduction. One is the solitary, where you just lay an egg here and an egg there and you keep going. And the other one is a mode of reproduction in which you build a body and then you produce offspring after you've grown for a while. The talk is not about this. This is just to tell you how the idea started, how I started to think that maybe cooperation and that eusociality represents kind of a different type of cooperation, and I started to think about it differently. And when I gave this talk 2 years ago at a conference, actually Rick Michaud was kind of instrumental in pointing out that the same model would be very, very useful to think about transitions to multicellularity. So Moving away from your sociality, which I'm very happy to talk about at the end if you're interested, I thought I'd discuss how that idea developed. So this kind of staying together where the offspring don't leave or the mother and daughter cells don't separate seems to be the kind of we find in multicellularity in cyanobacteria or in the Volvox algae. And it seems to us to be different, and we call this staying together, and not just us. I mean, this is that terminology exists, and it seemed to be very different from this other kind of multicellularity, if you will, which is formed by aggregation, where different types of individuals might actually be, or at least different individuals need to come together to form an aggregate. This seems to imply much more a need for an alignment of interest, and it could even involve different genotypes that need to come together to form this aggregate. And this seemed much more similar to the kind of games that we were studying earlier, where you need to think about what kind of mechanisms might make independent individuals align their interests. And so when then we wanted to think about these two different ways of achieving, of creating complexes. One was the staying together, the other one was the aggregation. And as we were thinking about that, we realized, well, it's not just in multicellularity. There are also other transitions that might be able to be described in this way. So if we think of protocells, and we imagine a world of lipid vesicles and free RNAs that might come in a coming together event, aggregate and form something of this sort, where now the RNA can continue to multiply inside the cell until the, sorry, not the cell, but the lipid vesicle, until at some point by some event, the vesicle separates and takes some part of the existing RNA inside. Or endosymbiosis, where you have two different types of bacteria that might come together, and then there will be other staying together events. And as I mentioned, social behavior or eusocial behavior. So we kind of wanted to step back from calling it cooperation or defection or anything like that, and just very abstractly start to wonder what happens when you form complexes in this form. What can we learn when we try to strip away these terms that have so much meaning and try to understand? So for instance, this is a model where we assume that complexes get formed by just like I was saying earlier with the ants. There is a complex has a certain reproduction rate, and whenever it reproduces with probability q, it turns into a complex of a larger size, and with probability 1 minus q, it creates one propagule. And then there's the solitary lifestyle. So we thought we didn't want to. There is this whole theory that's been developed for some time, discussing transitions to multicellularity that go through various levels of selection, where you have first the stage in which complexes are very, very simple, and the fitness of a complex is just the sum of the fitnesses of whatever makes it up. But we thought, let's just think for the very, very simple case where we just allow ourselves to just have an AI for as reproduction rate for a complex of size I, and we can play later with whatever those AIs might be. And so one can write a very simple linear differential equation model. Well, not quite linear because it has a density dependence term here, but in principle. Linear that shows the selection between these two different types under the assumption that at the beginning they occupy the same niche. And what we find is that is because they compete for the same resource, you'd expect competitive exclusion. So there are parameter regions where the solitary life will win, and then there are parameter regions where it makes sense to be a complex. And so here is the kind of landscape that we looked at. We thought, let's think about a situation where the ability to form a complex is actually costly. It costs me something. I'm a little bit worse off than the single cell. So for instance, A1 is not just B, which would be the reproductive rate of the singleton, it's B times something less than 1, so B times 0.95. And so we assume that maybe the first few complexes incur this cost of being able to form complexes. And so we assume here, for example, is 1 through 3. Then there is some benefit of forming complexes. Maybe you escape predation. Maybe you can sink deeper and get more food. Maybe something happens. And so we assume that there is some benefit here. And then later, we assume that maybe large complexes have, again, a cost, a very high cost, maybe because they have a higher mutation rate, they are much less stable, maybe because they have, I don't know, they just, there's no need for them to be that long, and there's no need to create something so big or something like that. So what we find is that for this particular fitness landscape, we find that it depends strongly on the probability Q of staying together. So if the probability to stay together is very low or very high, what happens is that if it's very low, you always end up making new propagules at a faster rate, so you end up with very short complexes which have this cost. If the probability of staying together is very high, then you end up with very long complexes, which again incur a cost. So the window of opportunity is somewhere in between, and this is what we observe. Now, again, this is when you assume that complexes are in the same niche. If however, they manage to find a new niche, so this is the old one, and maybe a few of the small ones compete with the ancestor, with the single cellular ancestor, but then larger complexes manage to find their new niche, you actually find coexistence. There is still a region here where the probability of staying together is so low that you never get the new complexes, so the single cell is stable. But then you get this very, very large window of opportunity for everything else to arise and coexist. So the interesting thing about staying together was to play with all these various kinds of fitness landscapes and try to understand what might happen when we don't actually assume. So we're talking here about really small complexes. It's like the very primitive, the very start of complex formation. And so but we didn't want to assume that AI is B times I, that you have basically the whole is the sum of the parts. So we just wanted to play with these various kinds of landscapes and see what happens. And it seems that this is just a very simple way by which one might be able to get complexes that outcompete other types of life. With coming together, things get more complicated because since we need to have aggregation, this means that individuals need to meet with each other. So you have to have a rate beta at which complexes or individuals meet to create other complexes. And so I said earlier that it might, when you aggregate, you actually might be able to have different genotypes in there. It's actually talking to experimental biologists, I realized that there is very little known about what really happens in the wild, how many of these biofilms are actually chimeras that we didn't really know, so we didn't really go into the theory of what happens when you have different genotypes. That is definitely the more interesting case where you have to come up with all sorts of mechanisms. But even if you assume that it's the same genotype, still there will be differences between coming together and staying together, so between this aggregation and the staying together. And this comes from the fact that you need to have an encounter rate. So the moment you introduce that in there, your equations become quadratic. And now they start to look more like the replicator equation that we used to use for games. So this starts to look more like the familiar kind of cooperation that I was talking about in the beginning. And so because it's a quadratic equation, what happens is here is staying together, here is coming together for the same parameter region, fitness landscapes. And what happens is that you can actually get coexistence because of this quadratic, because of the quadratic system of differential equations, even without assuming a niche. So the difference between staying together and coming together, at least at the very, very beginning, is that this one will lead to competitive exclusion in some way, whereas this one can actually allow for coexistence. And then one can ask, well, what kinds of defection can I allow in there? What does defection mean? What do cheaters mean? And I didn't actually even want to call them that way. Just try to imagine the kinds of particles that you might get For instance, in here you might get something that doesn't do anything to the, say a deed that gets added to these AIs, but doesn't do anything, doesn't increase the reproductive rate. You could get something that simply kills the whole complex. The moment when that arises, you can do anything in between. So there's a huge variety of something that might be called a cheater type. And similarly here, actually here it gets even more complicated depending on the ways in which they can stuck to each other and so on. So now that we just kind of started to look into this and understand a little bit the differences between these two mechanisms in a more abstract way, and I should say, for instance, if you actually really want to ask, well, what about mutation? You know, can I? What kind of defection can I get here? When can these complexes be cohesive? The answer always is no matter what kind of what assumptions I make about the kind of cheater that I might get in there. The answer is always that you want a developmental error threshold or something like an upper bound or in your mutation rate that will ensure the cohesiveness of your complex. And so that's not new. I mean, there are a lot of other papers, and Rick Michaud has done a lot about that. But it's in the context of this way of thinking about it, we show that we exactly get the same thing. Whereas here, you can have so many different types of defection that you really need to start thinking about mechanisms that might help keep that together. And so we started to wonder, well, okay, so if they seem so different mathematically, then what are the differences biologically? When do these things happen? When do you expect to get coming together? When do you expect to get staying together? And this is a paper by John Bonner in which he actually went to the origins of multicellularity, and here he really includes also the biofilms. I don't have a preference, I just wanted to make that clear. And he shows that the ones that staying together occurs mainly in aquatic environments and coming together occurs mainly in terrestrial environments. And if you look at our model, it kind of makes sense because if you think about aquatic environments where there are currents all the time, it's probably very unlikely to find other molecules that are like you so you can form an aggregate. So probably beta is very, very, very low. So you're kind of forced to do something like staying together. Whereas if you are on a terrestrial environment where you're probably very likely to be always surrounded by other individuals, by other bacteria and so on, it's probably beta is so high that it doesn't make sense to start a kind of a staying together building mechanism. And also he points out that interestingly, I don't really want to get into what complexity means, but if you think that plants and us and are more complex than slime molds, then he points out that staying together seems to have led to higher complexity in some form than coming together, where basically they only get together when they need to solve a problem and then they always go about their own way. And so we also started to wonder, well, how can we think about that? What other things can we predict that might happen? What other kind of pressures or environments might be leading for one as opposed to the other? So, for instance, aggregation might arise in a place where large complexes provide very high fitness advantages. So, where you want large complexes very, very quickly. If you need it to happen very quickly, then it's better to do it by aggregating than by doing staying together where you need a long time to divide and so on. If, on the other hand, large complexes don't provide fitness advantages but have a cost of forming complexes, then it might be better to do staying together. And so one thing that would be really interesting, and we're not experimentalists, so I was just thinking about that also in hearing so much work that is being done on multicellularity, is if you find things that can do both, as Will has found, Will Radcliffe and Mike Trevisano have done their work showing that they can evolve this kind of staying together in yeast. Andrew Murray shows that they also have both staying together and aggregation or flocculation, as he called it, in the circadian clock. So you can get something like yeast to do both. Then which one can you choose different environments such that you will force them to do one or the other? Can you actually influence the kind of social behavior that they will do? Or if you can't, and you just kind of get it, and so it's not clear how, but one manages to get both, can you put them in the same environment and stress them with the same kind of stressor, and then see how they react to the same? Because there's no reason a priori that something wouldn't be able to do both, so it would be very, very interesting to see what leads to one and what leads to the other, and which one is more successful if we find some sort of definition of success. But so this part of the work, kind of the message that I got from here is that the staying together and coming together are two building blocks that are used for biological construction on pretty much every scale. So it's important to understand in a very abstract way what they do. And they seem to be different when you look at them mathematically, so there must be also that must also translate into biological differences that are significant. And I feel that it is important to understand their differences and similarities before developing a general theory of what is cooperation and how that contributes to construction. But I have to say that in the process of doing so, I started being certain of what cooperation is, to realizing that cooperation comes in very, very many flavors, and to being, at the present moment, very confused about what is actually cooperation and what is defection. So, just for the rest of my talk, I'd like to go into something that might be a little bit more philosophical, but as a mathematician, I feel that there's a need for some framework that helps us talk about these things. So what actually is cooperation? On what time scale are we measuring cooperation? Is it something that it has an immediate observable effect? I mean, I see a bird staying at the nest and helping the parent, and I call that cooperation. Or do I look at the whole time scale, you know, at the lifetime of the bird, and I realize that at the end, the direct benefits of having stayed at the nest actually are huge, and it turns out to have been a very self-interested behavior. And what happens on a longer evolutionary time, because if you look at results like Paul Rainey has shown that cheaters, after a long time, after many, several generations, might turn into propagules, into something that is actually very, into the first propagules of multicellularity, then what a cheater means and whether it's bad or not might mean a totally different thing depending on the scale at which we are looking. And so, just to exemplify, because now I'm doing more ecological work, I've just moved to Princeton, and that's a department that's very interested in ecology. I just wanted to point to let you know about a problem that I've been thinking about that really triggered me to start questioning these kinds of the terms that we already have and when they might apply, and the kinds of approaches that we take to problems because of existing terms. So this will basically show the difference between this immediate observable and then the effect of on the lifetime of fitness. So I'm studying a population of Acacia drepanolobium trees. So same tree. Their problem are large herbivores that basically eat them and destroy them. The elephants are the most wasteful eaters I have ever seen. They just break everything and then leave a trail of broken trees behind. And the solution to this problem, interestingly, are the ants. These trees, in these swollen thorns that you see here, house ant colonies that when the tree basically provides food and shelter for the ants, and when the ants, and when an elephant comes and tries to grab the tree with its trunk, the ants go inside the trunk, and thousands of ants bite it, and the elephant goes away because it's unbearable. One ant, if it bites me, I'm very unhappy about it. So this is the solution. The interesting thing is that in this system that has exactly the same trees, Acacia drepanolobium trees, you'll find four different types of ants that are extremely aggressive, that are extremely competitive both intraspecifically and interspecifically. You will only find one ant species one ant colony on one tree at a time, and they have huge warfare going on between them. And so we find four different types. Because it's one ant on one tree, it's very tempting to always quantify the behavior or qualify the behavior, the relationship between the two. So one finds that there are two that are mutualists and two that are parasites. Basically, the mutualists do what you'd expect them to do. They attack the large herbivores when they come to the tree. The parasites are interesting. One of them increases mortality but in a kind of a slow fashion. So it kills the tree very, very slowly. The other one, it defends the tree, but it sterilizes. So the tree grows very, very nicely, but it doesn't ever reproduce. And so if you think about, okay, I have two mutualists and two parasites in the same system, then the question you want to ask is, well, what happens? How much better are the mutualists than the parasites? Or what keeps this going? You know, what's the equilibrium of these ants? Are they in equilibrium? What saves the trees and so on? But what happens is that my collaborators, and so this is not my work. This is the work that actually prompted me to start to want to work in this system. Realize that a tree lives much longer than an ant colony. A tree will live for 120 years, whereas an ant colony will live only for, you know, 1 or 2 years. It's because of this huge turnover, because of this competition between them. And so they said, well, it doesn't quite make sense to ask what an ant does to a tree. You kind of have to look at the whole lifetime fitness of the tree and see what the whole system does to it. And so they realized by doing so and doing all sorts of taking all the demographic parameters and making these 50-year simulations, what they find is that a tree that is occupied by all four. So first of all, they find that most trees in the system, 80% of the trees are occupied by all four throughout their lifetime. And so then what they find is that the trees that are occupied by all four sequentially at some point throughout their lives do better than any other combination. They do better even better than the pairing of a tree with the best of all mutualists. And so then the interesting question is, you know, what does this mean? I end up with a system where basically I have two partners. Each one of them independently makes the host worse off, but the two of them together make the host better off. And so in that case, what is then mutualism? Is it because if I think about mutualism as a pairwise interaction, it makes me ask the wrong question of the system. It makes me want to ask how the mutualists and parasites balance each other. If I realize that actually the whole is not the sum of the parts, and I use that kind of metaphorically to say that no pairwise interaction basically tells me what happens to the whole system, then I don't really know how to define mutualism. It becomes more like a property of the network. I have a network of mutualists that together do something. And as I start to look in the literature, this becomes more and more clear that there are other cases where infections with bacteria protect against viruses or other situations. So I just wanted to leave you with this, with what puzzled me, and the same kind of questions apply also for cooperators and cheaters, and what is what, and what kind of explanations, or what kind of questions we need to ask on different time scales of different behaviors to be able to address them. Thank you very much, and I thank my collaborators.
Thank you very much, Karina. So do we have any questions for Karina? So why do two ant colonies generate the benefit? Do you have any ideas around the mechanism of that?
Thank you. Yes, the mechanism is very simple. And you only need to look at the parasites, actually. There's a dominance hierarchy between the two parasites. So the one that kills is much stronger than the one that sterilizes. So what will happen is that the sterilizer you will find confined on small trees, and the one that kills the tree, it does so by nesting inside the trunk of the tree. So it makes these cavities where it needs a pretty big tree to be able to, so the tree doesn't break down when it starts to form the colonies inside. So the more dominant in terms of strength ant is interested in a stronger, bigger trees. So the other one is confined on smaller trees. And when you're small, you're not so interested in reproduction. you're more interested in surviving, because small trees get crushed all the time or get eaten and so on. So what happens if they, because the dominance hierarchy ensures this kind of this kind of sequential occupation is that you'll get trees that grow very strong and very tall, but they don't reproduce at all until that point. And when they are at that point, they become interesting to the killing, to the parasite that kills them. And when that happens, the tree starts to, I don't know exactly how to describe this, but it puts all the effort into reproduction. So it's a kind of a very short-lived, you grow, you don't reproduce at all, but then when you are starting to be parasitized this way, you put everything into reproduction. These trees are flowering all the time, and so it compensates in that way. Yeah, sorry.
Okay.
In your simple mathematical modeling of multicellularity, what about genetic drift? Presumably at the early stages, when these things are just getting started, that could be a pretty important thing. Are you putting it just in with a simulation, or how does that change things?
You mean in these staying together models?
They're simple ordinary differential equations. The actual dynamics, like in any chemical reaction with a small number of molecules, will have lots of fluctuations, and it will be multiplicative noise typically. Mm-hmm. So will that change things, or what will it do?
Yeah, unfortunately, I think we didn't look at that. We explored what happens when you start, you know, could it just be neutrality that keeps it going for a while, that keeps going the system for a while, you know, so you allow, most complexes, just AI is B times I, but we didn't put noise in there in any way that you would. Yeah, but that's something to follow up on. Yes.
Hello, Mike.
Yeah.
And eukaryotes are usually diploid, so I mean these are fairly complex changes to cells. So one obvious question is, mutation arises that makes you just a stickier cell or something. What happens in the heterozygous individuals? Really, it's not just a matter of drift. It's an issue of the fitness consequences in a heterozygote, right? It's easy to think about the extremes and get fixed. It's the intermediate state that really determines whether you can go to that extent.
Yeah, we didn't explicitly put sexual reproduction in there because actually we started to think that sexual reproduction is also a coming together event in its own right. So we thought that adds a level of complexity that we weren't prepared to address. But we did have, going back to David's question, we did have mutation rates here. We did have mutation. So we allowed for these things to mutate. The question is to what? So we tried to explore various types of mutants that might cause, and this is what I was trying to say earlier, that you could have different, that they could have different contributions to the complexes, and you can see what happens to that. But we didn't. Yeah. But that's a very good question. We want to study that at some point.
So you're. I have it, unfortunately for him. So for your image of the acacia and the ants, I thought that was interesting, particularly because it makes one think about caution between cause and consequence. So particularly with respect to these coevolutionary cooperative dynamics, are the observation, I'm not saying that the authors of the paper are saying it about the ants and the trees, but we might be tempted to say, oh, look, the ants are, this observation is the consequence of subsequent of adaptation, as opposed to the cause of interactions that weren't adaptive necessarily for the tree. So whenever one sees these coming togethers or staying togethers, one always has to keep in mind the distinction between the cause and the consequence that other people have made here today already. But I think that's particularly relevant for the acacia and ant.
Yeah, I agree. And know how that system came about is actually very interesting, and how the existence of the other types of ants changes the behavior of one type is actually very, very interesting, and it's part of what the work that we're doing right now to go to different parts in Kenya where only subsets of those ants exist on the same trees and try to see a little bit what subsets of ants do together. Yeah.
So I'd like to explore the interesting distinction that you've made between staying together and coming together. And I'm wondering if I'm wondering if these are dichotomous or are they coincident in part? For example, don't the particles or offspring staying together have to decide, so to speak, to stay together and in so doing undertake the same thinking, if you will, that the ones coming together do? And conversely, could animal offspring that had been separated, as a, even though they were offspring, then decide to re-aggregate? And so I'm curious about the distinction and how clear-cut the distinction is.
Between staying together and coming together. You are absolutely correct in pointing this out, and I think coming together, if it's the same genotype and it's just offspring that just happen to be lying around and growing by themselves, but they're clonal, and then they manage to find a way to come together, that seems to be less of an interesting case and less of a different case. It just that just requires their ability to somehow find a way to stick to each other and probably not to disperse. But if you look at coming together that has different genotypes,
yeah,
that has much more this that seems to have much more this flavor of different interests that need to somehow be. So I don't know. So I think the more clear-cut distinction is between staying together where everything is clonal and coming together where you really have different genotypes. Getting your question?
So in that case, speaking, turning to the issue of diploidy,
yeah,
would then the offspring of a diploid have to, if they stay together, would they have to come together to stay together if they were the offspring of a diploid? Because they would be heterogeneous?
Yeah, exactly, yeah. Exactly. Yeah. So that's where, I mean, we kind of try to touch on that, but mm-hmm. we're uncertain about exactly. So for diploidy, for sex, that kind of, it is a coming together event, right? So it is an aggregation event. Everything starts with that aggregation event, which is absolutely necessary, even if they do staying together afterwards. If you take the ants, for example, and the offspring stay at the nest, but first the virgin queen has to mate with a male, that first is a quadratic term of needing to find the male and having the sex, and then doing the staying together afterwards. Yeah.
Right. Okay. So then the last.
But it just seems so. What puzzled us very much is that it seems that the conflicts during the sex event, the conflicts seem to be resolved differently. It just seems to be a kind of. I think there are very different flavors of what form conflict can take in this coming together situations. But in fact, if you are stuck with each other, then you would assume that conflict is much easier, that there's no way for them to separate again the zygote.
Okay, and just one follow-up then on what you said, which is interesting. So do you view the mating itself as a cooperative act? Because it's a coming together in your terminology. So do you regard sexual reproduction and mating as a cooperative act?
Well,
from the beginning, yeah.
I think that's what I'm trying to do, move a little bit away from cooperation and talk about interactions and call it rather a coming together and then try to think about what is cooperation under these conditions. So this is my talk was trying to go a little bit in the other.
But coming together would not be... Or could that be aggressive? I mean, is coming together automatically cooperative, or is coming together possibly antagonistic?
I think it could be, but again, I think I would need to know what a good definition of cooperation is.
Okay. So thank you.
So maybe I can add a quick note of clarity to that. I think that the question of ancestral and derived, or the origination versus the maintenance of a character, figure really heavily into this discussion. Or a cause and consequence. And so I think one of the distinctive features of a fair meiosis and a fair mitosis is that you can look at the reason that in fact coming together in the case of syngamy represents a cooperative act, because there's already a mechanism that's evolved to ensure that both the maternal and the paternal genotypes are fairly represented in the mitotic progeny. And so until you know, you could say it's a derived condition that it's a cooperative or a collaborative state now because a mechanism evolved that allowed it to become cooperative and collaborative. And then initially, my guess would be, although you might start at a different place than I would, Joan, is that it wasn't initially had a high potential for conflict, but that it currently doesn't in most cases.
Yeah, thank you. I think that's very, and I should have said that throughout many times, that we really look at just the very beginning, trying exactly to go a little bit away from what we observe now and more to what might have happened at the very transition, the most primitive cases.
So I would like to follow up a little bit on this remark. And you mentioned before that the different types of ants are mutually exclusive. And I wonder in that case if, in order to guarantee the sequence, ants that were abolished have to come from somewhere. So the question is whether they come from other trees, which may be synchronized in phase with that tree, or maybe it's not totally abolished, and so there is a expansion and expansion of a small population.
You mean so when there's a war between two colonies, actually it's like fighting one on one, and the one that has the bigger colony, that's the one that wins, and then it expands onto the next tree. So there will be colonies that cover several trees, but they all reproduce, and there's a difference. What is an interesting thing is that even though I told you about this hierarchy dominance when the colonies are already formed, there's a dominance in how good the queens are at occupying new trees, at starting new colonies. So there will be, the sterilizing queen actually is a much better colonizer. It's a very weak competitor against the other ant, but it's a much better colonizer, so it will send queens far, far away. And so is that what you're asking?
Well, not really, because over the lifetime of the tree, it needs both colonies, right?
It gets all four, yeah.
Gets all four. So the question is, if three of them are abolished and you have one colony that takes over, where do the other colonies come from?
I'm not sure I understand what the question.
I mean, in the subsequent stage or subsequent phase in the life cycle of the tree, it has four colonies, right?
Yeah.
In every phase, though, you have only one.
Yes.
Which ensures that it stays only one, right?
Yeah.
So where do the other colonies come from?
Just from neighboring trees. So this is a system with, let's say, 1,000 trees, and all four species exist on different trees, and you can map it, and you'll find neighborhoods with one species, then neighboring other parts with other species, and so on. And at some point, the crowns, there will be some ants that go on the ground and try to attack the colony on a particular tree. There will be, most often though, what happens is that two tree crowns touch each other, and that forces the two colonies to fight. And the one that wins takes over both trees. And so that's how takeovers of trees happen. Is this?
Yes, and the related question to that is whether the life cycles of nearby trees are somehow coordinated in such a way that you will have one colony in one tree and another colony in a nearby tree, and then they will exchange the colonies later.
That's a very interesting question. I find plants to be extremely difficult to know what strategies they have. I find them very, very tricky. I don't know if these trees have anything to say in this, or it's everything just determined by the ants fighting with each other and just getting bigger and being able to expand to a different tree. So I have no idea. What I can tell you is that when a tree is being sterilized, it actually stops reproducing, stops trying, or it tries a little bit, but diverts most of the resources to growth. So sterilization is actually a behavior of the ant that kind of wants the tree to invest more in that colony. It seems to be a consequence of the very highly competitive system. So trees seem to be forced into different kinds of strategies, but whether the trees have a choice in which, you know, whether they make themselves more interesting for one colony or for the other, it's very hard to tell. We haven't been able to do that. But that's a great question. I wish I knew.
Hi. So in the theoretical part of your talk, you consider coming together events of the fraternal kind, so they're like kinds coming together.
Exactly.
And then you move on to the empirical evidence from the ants and the acacias, where it's that's a symbiosis of unlike kinds, right? So they're each different types of thing. I wonder how in that situation, I assume that there isn't vertical transmission of ants and seeds from the trees, right? So those coming together events happen on a per generation basis. Unlike, for example, the coming together of ants and the Attine ants and the fungi that they carry around with them, and they suppress the fungus's sexual reproduction mechanism so that they have vertical transmission of the fungus with the ant colonies, so daughter colonies have daughters of the fungus too. How would that kind of situation look in this framework?
Well, so two things. One is that there is a little bit of an interesting vertical transmission where on baby trees around the parent tree that's doing fine, you will often see the same colony expanding. So there's a little bit of that. And interestingly, these trees, even though they have so many problems with so many herbivores, they don't actually disperse so much. Most seeds, and one potential explanation is that they've kind of figured out this mutualist, so they want the offspring to inherit the same location. So there is a little bit of that, but I think in the sense of applying the theory, this would have to take into then I would have to move to different types coming together. And I think the final example, the acacia system that I gave as an example, is more to exemplify the way words lead you to ask very different questions and kind of to justify why I would like to move away a bit from what cooperators and cheaters mean, rather than to say that's a system that I would necessarily study in this framework. Although I appreciate that, I mean, that is really, it is a coming together event, any symbiosis, any interaction, actually. But I wasn't necessarily suggesting it as a, it was more like a side note at the end to justify.
Okay, thank you very much, Karina.
Thank you. So.